And to that piece of lieutenant that's always on his podcast, bash us,
All right, everybody. Eric Dimby, most complaining cop, NYPD. This is New York's finest retirement filter podcast. Along with me is the founder and the co-host of the podcast, John McCarry, retired lieutenant. We got a great show for you. We're interviewing Marlon Marachi. Marlon is a great guest. He's actually retired LAPD, and I like to call it East meets West. So we're starting to expand our network here. Met plenty of law enforcement from California, right? We had Hector Bravo here. Of course, now we have our good friend Marlon. Marlon, I actually went on his podcast, Internal Affairs' podcast. And Marlon, let's just get right into it. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you grew up, where you grew up, why you became a cop, and just tell us what makes you tick.
Man, you know what? Instead of taking a major trip down memory lane, why don't we just kind of wrap it up with the fact that I was born and raised in Lima, Peru. So I came here in the, I don't want to give my age too much, but I came here in the 1980, actually. And I've been here for 40 plus years, and it's best decision my mom ever made for us to have us here from Lima, Peru. And let's see. I ended up living in the Los Angeles, 818 San Fernando Valley. If any of your guests are familiar with Los Angeles, because when everybody thinks of LA, it's real huge. It's not like New York. New York, by the way, I went there once, and it's just phenomenal. I really was just, I mean, I was in awe the whole time I was there. And it's that true saying that, you go to New York and you come back home and you're like, man, New York doesn't have nothing on LA. LA just, it's nothing compared, no comparison whatsoever. Loved it. And so I got into police academy in 1998. I did 24 years in the Los Angeles Police Department. And about the biggest influence that led me to become a cop was my best friend. I was in the United States Navy on my third year. I didn't want to reenlist. And my best friend decided to, give it a shot. He went on a ride along. He's been thinking. And again, we were like 25, 26 years old. And he did a ride along. And after that, he's like, this is it. So in my last year serving in the Navy, he was already in the academy and doing his probationary period. And I got to tell you, man, you know what? He's been my best friend since high school. And I just took his word for it. You know, we have a lot of compatibility. You know, we're like two peas in a pod. And next thing you know, whatever concern I had about becoming a cop, you know, as a matter of fact, perhaps you're not familiar, or maybe you are, but at the time that I decided to come on the job, there was that Diallo shooting, I believe. The Diallo shooting that happened, I believe it was a young male black who was walking up to his apartment, and cops, I can't recall how many, but an OIS ensued, and it was 40 rounds that were shot, and he was just coming out, and I believe he had an object, and it was his wallet or whatever the case may be. So you can imagine the impact it had. Back then, you know, I'm taking you back to like 1991, 1992. And that was a landmark historical case that just hit the nation. And the whole time I was thinking to myself, oh, my God, do I really want to, you know, be a cop and, you know, carry a gun and get involved in an OIS and live with that for the rest of my life? But I got to tell you, man, once I applied, once I started going through the process, all my concerns, I wouldn't say fears, but you know, the nervousness, you know, and I suppose the fear of the unknown. I mean, we all know that when we do this kind of work, just became very motivation and dedication. I was pumped and I got in. And let me tell you, man, the best decision I ever made. Here we are 25 years later. July of this year will be 2 years since I've been retired from the Los Angeles Police Department.
Oh, God bless, man. Thank you for your service. You know, thank you for your service to the people of the city of LA and, of course, to the United States of America and the Navy. You know, it's an honor to have you on here. You retired as an LAPD sergeant. Could you just take us back a little bit to when you coming on the job? What was your ethos? What was your mindset? Rookie cop. And then as you grow, how, what's your mindset? What do you tell like young guys that are coming on now?
Well, you know what? Good question, John, because obviously we can all agree that police work has changed completely. I mean, 180 degrees, probably even 360 for that matter, where I'll just give you a quick example. When I was in the academy and we were doing tactics, they had an acronym called ATD, which is ask, tell, and do. So basically you ask someone, hey, put your hands behind your head. You're going to jail today. You know, no, I'm not doing F you. Okay. Well, I'm telling you to put your hands behind your head because you're going to get arrested. F you, I'm not doing it. And then of course the D is you do it. You know, where nowadays we have to de-escalate, you know, and we have to do many other options and other things to do when you want to affect an arrest. So that's something that just kind of sticks out in terms of police work. And what is it that I would ask? I'm sorry. What is it that I would tell your audience who's coming on the job is just know that the rules of and the regulations of the game have changed, but there's nothing that should stop you or prevent you from doing this profession, because it's just a great ride. It's a great journey, and you're going to get so much success, and you're going to meet the best people that are going to be in your life all the way to the grave. So what can I say besides just be flexible and be understanding that there's a lot that you're going to have to learn. What I did 25 years ago is not compared to what someone comes on now. I got to be honest with you and say that there is such a high expectation for officers, you know, to function, whether it's patrol or any other type of assignment that you're going to be doing. And so maybe that's something that we can have a discussion as, you know, for the near future, how we can minimize and perhaps find other ways to cope with everything that's expected of a police officer.
You know, I'm glad that you brought that up, right? I mean, for you, your acronym is ATD. I mean, for the police department, when I came on the job, and John, the same thing, we worked in the same era. We actually came on together 6 months apart. We worked together as rookies. And we were told the same thing by the veteran police officers. It was, you know, ask someone to do something, you tell them, and then you make them, right? It's almost, for us, it was ATM. ATM, right? Ask, ATM. Tell, make.
Yes.
Now, I would argue that there is a component to that that allows for de-escalation. But John and I talk on the podcast all the time about de-escalation. And for the politicians, it has become a buzzword. Could you tell the correct public, especially since we're going to get into that, but your career, you ended working in the internal affairs part of the of LAPD. That's part of your podcast. Can you tell us what your interpretation of de-escalation is? Because this is a buzzword that is constantly misused and misappropriated by the leftist politicians, these anti-police advocates. So if you could just give us your interpretation, I appreciate it, especially with your level of experience.
Right. So the way I would flush all the details out of de-escalation would be something along the lines like, look, you can't just offer it and think that it's something magical is going to happen when the suspect, you know, you're trying to effect an arrest or prevent an escape or for that overcome resistance when you're applying force. So there always has to be a buy-in from that person. And guess what? You're not always going to get the buy-in. You're not, you know, you can't just come up to someone and say, hey, you know what? Congratulations. You have been de-escalated, you know, and that's not the way it works. Basically. Yes. You got to get an offer. It's kind of like a contract. Hey, you know what? I'm offering you this. I'm telling you, these are the kind of issues that you're going to be facing if you don't decide to comply, right? Whatever that situation may be, but you have a say in it. You, meaning the suspect, has a saying. You either are going to take that offer or you're just going to reject that offer. Now, with that being said, there is a lot of situations where, guess what? We're not even talking about de-escalation. Us three roll up in an operation, specialized unit, serving a search warrant, you know, or we decided to go to the liquor store and someone comes out blasting with an AK-47. and running down the street southbound, you're trying to get a crime broadcast, and you're after him, right, to stop the threat. Guess what? There is no time to de-escalate, at least not there and then. Now, if he barricades himself and, you know, in an open field, vacant field, vacant room, whatever, okay, now we can start talking different tactics, different situations. But at times, just so the audience knows, de-escalation is not something that's always has to be offered. Now, do you want to offer? Absolutely. And certain circumstances, depending on the incident, would, you know, require for you to do that. So, which is not a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. I got to be honest with you, even ATM, well, hell, that sounds like de-escalation. And by the way, de-escalation is not something verbal either. It's all, it's your demeanor. It's your body language. It's the intangibles, the things that you do that could cause you to, all right, I'm trying to de-escalate the situation. Just because I'm not saying it doesn't mean that I'm not doing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you're saying emotional intelligence, right? Your physical demeanor, right? Everything that, every point, data point that you could pick up in that situation, just don't rush in and be a brute. I mean, yeah, but I agree with Eric. Like, it does, the word does get thrown around in those crazy situations, like you just talked about, where someone's charging at you with an AK-47 shooting at you. Like, the cops could have de-escalated that. It's like, whoa. The de-escalation there is we're firing at him with our firearms. Like, that's that. So you did. I mean, you served in internal affairs, and you actually named your podcast the Internal Affairs, a police podcast. Could you tell us about your time in internal affairs, what you believe in the Internal Affairs Bureau's mission is for the LAPD, and why'd you go ahead and name the podcast after that? Like, what's the basis of the podcast?
I'm glad, you know what? That's going to start being my first question to every single guest. And the light bulb just hit not too long ago, is that, you know what, Marlon, that was pretty bold for you to name it Internal Affairs. What I will say this, you know, I'll throw it back to both of you guys, especially Eric, because he's come on the show, and I never had a chance to ask him, is when you first saw the actual banner or the logo or the name, what were you actually thinking? You know, considering Internal Affairs is the stigma that has been in existence for decades, that we're just evil people.
Well, immediately, right? When if you remember when we did the podcast, I actually said to you offline, I said, you know something? It's kind of gutsy, right? I says, it takes balls to actually name your podcast. I think we were actually texting each other. And I said, you know what? It's kind of ballsy to actually have the name Internal Affairs Podcast. And remember, you said, why? I said, well, just think about the backlash you're going to get from some of the guys. And, all right, they're exactly that. There's going to be some type of stigma. They're going to think you're a rat. You're someone they can't trust. Wow. Someone they're going to be scared to talk to, right? So the fact that you actually named your podcast, I say that takes guts. Whether I agree with them or not, it takes guts to do that, because knowing that that may be some of the challenges that you face.
Yeah, and you know what? I am a law enforcement instructor for the Savage Training Group, which is a company out here based in Northern California. And we have a California post-certified course, a 2-day course right now. First day is internal affairs, and day two is OIS investigation. So basically, my partner, James Tacchini, and I, and my partner works up north in the San Francisco Police Department. We basically have students who are sergeants, that are being assigned to internal affairs or being voluntold to go to internal affairs. We do have some lieutenants, and sometimes command staff will show up in the class. And the purpose of the class is to pretty much get you to understand what misconduct is. So if you're asking me, you know, that's very, very important. You'd be surprised not many people can actually define what alleged misconduct is, even though it's in your manual and you probably won't read it, which I understand. And to know how to do a thorough, really quality, precise, no stone goes unturned investigation. And so the controversy where what I've learned from teaching, it's been going on for over a year now, is do you do this job to protect the cops, or do you do it, you know, to, I suppose, burn a cop, you know? And so, and oftentimes, when you do take that position where, hey, I want to protect them. I mean, think about it. If you get involved in an OIS, you want to ensure that you're doing such a good, thorough investigation that you want that cop to give the best compelled statement about what was going on in your mind when you pull the trigger, right? No any different than if someone in the public decides to make a complaint about, I don't know, you were discourteous or you were, you know, you were real rude, disrespectful, you know, something along those lines. Well, you want that investigator to turn every single stone and say that didn't happen, you know? And so that gives, and I guess I suppose I sound a little contradicting that, yeah, I'm here to protect cops, but you got to be careful with that, because what if you get those allegations of someone who is raping, you know, victims, or someone who is, you know, out there, I don't know, getting in domestic violence or DUIs, or better yet, someone who is badge heavy, someone who is in the streets cutting corners, and every time they go in an interview, they lie about it, you know, because they feel as though violating your constitutional rights. I mean, that can go on and on. But when you get those cases and you investigate as an IA investigator, you got to be careful saying you're going to protect cops, because that's not what your job is, you know? And so one of many reasons why I decided to do this podcast is because I truly feel that if you look at every police podcast that's out right now, this is an untapped subject. And this type of topic, it's very taboo, and not many people want to talk about how we should hold the department accountable for what they put me through, considering that all these allegations, I was exonerated, but look at the way it went down, and look how you treated me and my family, for that matter, and my colleagues, you know, and you know what, look at the impact it has on me, right? And look at the impact it has on morale. You know, we don't know that. So that was one of the reasons why I decided to do that. Another reason is because a lot of times we can learn from this accountability. We can learn that, hey, if the department screwed up and they got it wrong, well, let it be some lessons learned. As long as we do it very professional, respectful, we can all have that conversation. Why not? But here's the deal, John, Eric, we don't have that conversation. And sometimes you'll get guests, they'll come on the podcast and say, guess what, man? Yeah, I actually took a 20-day suspension because of this is what happened. And you know what? If I can tell your audience, don't do this, look what happened to me, then I'm all for that. Because at the end of this all, what we're trying to do is to make people aware and just kind of educate them on something that perhaps could happen. I mean, I think, Eric, I told you this, and I say this a lot. You know, there's over 18,000 agencies in the entire United States. There's over 800,000 police officers in the United States. And you know what? There's just not enough. There's not enough podcasts, not enough platforms for us to get our word out, let alone when we talk about a topic that's very taboo. And if we can have these conversations, hoping that someone's listening and watching, saying, you know what? Yeah, that's, I'm kind of going through that. And you know what? Maybe I shouldn't be doing this kind of stuff. And that kind of makes sense. So.
Yeah, you know what? You know what's it's interesting. And again, I say I think it's gutsy, and I think what's interesting though also is something that you said. So I just want to take note. So for the New York City Police Department, our careers, I think it has a different entity. By what you're saying, I'm not sure, but if you could clarify for me. So, yeah, in the New York City Police Department, we have Internal Affairs Division. We also have a unit below that, which is called the inspections unit. Well, they don't address necessarily misconduct and corruption, but it's more like in-house discipline behavior, maybe uniform infractions, maybe administrative infractions. Right. But what we also have is a separate entity. So now I heard you say that someone is discourteous. That's something that you would investigate. But right, for the New York City Police Department, we have a separate entity called the Civilian Complaint Review Board.
And CCRB.
CCRB. So could you explain, do you have a CCRB or is that part of the Internal Affairs? How does that work for the Los Angeles Police Department?
Right. So let me kind of walk you through what happens when someone decides to allege misconduct on an officer. There's what I call cut and paper, cut and face sheet. And here we go. Basically, there's all different kinds of portals. You can do it online. You can call a hotline, or you can come up to an officer saying, I want to make a complaint. Obviously, if you do a traffic stop, I want to see your supervisor, et cetera, et cetera. And so that particular face sheet, when you determine that there is alleged misconduct, in other words, that sergeant says, yep, it's either going to be one of the four, right? Violation of policy and procedure, neglect of duty, a criminal offense, and last but not least, your unbecoming conduct, which is what we call CUBO, conduct unbecoming an officer. So if it falls in any of those four, you're going to cut a face sheet, right? But you as a sergeant have to determine that. So once you cut that face sheet, you upload it in the system, right? And that lands in internal affairs. So internal affairs has a unit of sergeants where they actually look at every single face sheet. I got to tell you, I don't know about New York NYPD, but I think at one point when I was there from 2011 to 2015, to answer your question, John, I was there for about almost 5 years. We had an excess of 3,000 public complaints a year. And someone has the job to look at these complaints and say, okay, if it's pretty minor discourtesy or like a neglected duty or a violation of a policy or something like that, they'll ship it back to the actual division, which I believe you guys call it a precinct, right? So it goes back to that division and then it gets assigned to a sergeant and he or she is the IO, the investigating officer, and they get the blessing, go investigate it and have at it. If it's serious or if, you know, obviously if it's a criminal offense, DUI, domestic violence, whatever, excessive force. I mean, you can actually file a civil excessive force against an officer and it's an automatic IA. And so those get investigated in internal affairs. They'll assign it to an internal affairs investigating officer. They're blessed and they go in and start investigating it. So yeah, and before I forget, I'm a sergeant in 2007. So I retired as a sergeant 15 years in 2022. And so the majority of my career as a sergeant is where I got the bug, the itch of discipline. And so I've been doing this for about, I want to say 12 to 15 years. So it's getting up there in years doing this kind of stuff. So that's kind of like a little bit of a walkthrough of a complaint. But here's the problem. I shouldn't say the problem. The challenge and the hurdles is that what you don't know as an accused employee is that you don't know if it's being influenced. You don't know if it's being investigated fully. And you don't know, which happens, and I'm sure it happens in a lot of organizations, is that at some point, not all the time, it gets a little personal and it gets self-serving. So someone can probably say in the levels review, hey, I don't like John, I don't like Eric. You know what? Just make it sustained and give him 5-day suspension. You know, so it doesn't become about the process. It becomes about themselves.
Yeah. So I served 2 years, 8 months in the NYPD's Internal Affairs Bureau.
Okay.
3,000 complaints we probably would get every 10 days. It was like, so the number you just threw out, I was like, whoa, because the phone rings in internal affairs nonstop. It never stops
ringing. Oh my
gosh. All day long, you know, all day long, you have intake, you have people reviewing each allegation that comes in all the way up to a chief, gets divvied out to hundreds of different of units and possibly even going back down to command level because it's so much work. And even in that level of work, there are things that get lost in the sauce because there's just so much volume coming in.
Wow.
Personally, I did anti-crime the majority of my career. I had a few investigations against me and I was afraid of internal affairs before going to them because I didn't really understand it. But I did have a serious allegation against me. I conducted a SNU operation and we locked up, we were picking off buyers, you know, and then we eventually we went and picked up the seller and his girlfriend who was bringing the buyers to this location outside of the methadone clinic. And I would do the same thing. I did everything that would, regardless of my arrest, I would always do the same thing. I'd bring them back to the squad. I would speak to them. I'd read them their rights. And then I would say, you know, this is your opportunity to tell the judge what happened. And what they would do is without fail, they'd write a confession. So this guy goes home. He goes home. He burns his girlfriend on a stove. He burns himself on the stove. And they call internal affairs and they say that I burned them on the radiator. Only problem was it was in July and the radiators aren't turned on in the precincts until about November. So So a complete lie. But Internal Affairs goes out there. They conduct a proper investigation, thorough investigation, and they kick it. It gets down to nothing. And I realized at that point, I'm like, you know what? Internal Affairs is I don't even say it's a necessary evil. It's a luxury to have an Internal Affairs Bureau, because without that Internal Affairs Bureau, that allegation is going directly to the district attorney's office. And Now you're looking at a district attorney saying whether, oh, wow, look at the facts that I barely have any because we didn't do a thorough investigation like an Internal Affairs Bureau would do. And more than likely, you would see a lot more cops getting indicted and charged if it wasn't for Internal Affairs. So I just wanted to add that in. So like, I never had the chip on my shoulder with Internal Affairs, but my chip with Internal Affairs later in my career and even now is I believe that there is a politicized twinge to a lot of it. Not saying that from the investigator standpoint, but when you're kicking it back up to the higher ups, you know, I as much as I think Internal Affairs is a good thing, I think in the NYPD, it's been corrupted to actually look out for the job, even when they're not complying with the law, as opposed to ensure integrity with the workers. Yes, that is the vital function in Internal Affairs, that we're going to make sure that we don't have any dirty cops, because nobody wants a dirty cop. And if you do, you're a dirty cop, right? So like, but did you see anything political during your time where you're like, whoa, you know?
Yeah. So a couple of things to add to what you just said, John, so important is, first and foremost, I just want to make sure your audience understand is that when we start talking about misconduct and dirty cops and stuff like that, is it's a very, very small fraction, a complete, very, very tiny, small fraction. I mean, if there's over 3,000 complaints from 2011, 2015 a year, 96.4% of those complaints came back unfounded. So you really have to worry about that 4%. I mean, do the numbers. If you have and back then we had over 10,000 cops. So you're talking about 0.0000001% of the population. So I just want to make sure we're clear that you're absolutely right. It is the necessary evil. My guest, one of the guests on the podcast said that best. It's, you know what? You have to have checks and balances, but at the same time is what I learned watching all the politics is what we call peer influence peddling. There is a lot of influence peddling going on as the levels of review. And that's just something that I have witnessed, meaning there is, so in LAPD, we have a unique system where if you're brought up on serious allegations of misconduct, like false statements, misleading statements, perjury, think of just real bad behavior. And you go to a hearing. So this hearing is a three panel member comprised of two command staff officers, and one civilian. And basically it's a trial, right? So the advocate, the associate advocate, which is Internal Affairs, that was my job. I represent the chief of police, has to put on the case. We plead in the beginning. You're going to plead not guilty, obviously. And here we go. Opening arguments. I get to bring in witnesses to testify. I get to introduce evidence so they can examine. And then once the department rests, then the defense puts on their case. And now the defense attorney does the same thing. They put on their case in chief. And then once they rest, we do closing arguments. And here we go, right? I've done about 30 plus of these voter rights. And so what I started to realize is that after it's set and done, and now they're deliberating whether you're going to be found guilty or not guilty, if you're brought up on one allegation and you're found guilty, we move on to the penalty phase. The penalty phase is your package review, and you get to bring in as many character witnesses as you want. And so the board members hear these witnesses and they review your package. And here we go. They're going to determine what they believe would be a recommended penalty. Now, the chief of police can only reduce down the penalty. He cannot up the penalty whatsoever. So if you are recommended to be terminated, the only thing the chief can do is downgrade and, you know, reduce the penalty to maybe suspension or whatever the case may be. So that's kind of what happens in internal affairs and LAPD disciplinary system. And I was part of that for quite some time. And I've done, like I said, 30 plus of those cases. But here's the challenge. Five of those particular hearings were termination cases. They actually were found guilty for a false statement. And during the pendency, they removed them. They got fired. They were done. The question is not so much those five, because we can all agree that, you know what, we don't want a dirty cop. You know, we don't want a bad actor, a bad apple on the department. Is what happened to those other 25 cases? And that's what I believe gets the stigma of I being the dark sign, or I having the rat squad, is because a lot of these cases that end up at this level, right, the highest level, didn't really merit for everybody to go through all that. I mean, you're talking a lot of time and effort. And here's the worst part of it all, John. It's how you treat that employee. You can be waiting for your hearing for over a year. You only get paid for the first 30 days. After that, you're on the books, but you're unpaid. And you're waiting for your day in court. And I got to tell you, man, that is a bit archaic. I 100% agree, and I think I told you before we started recording that Joe Gamaldi comes on, and he's right. There's a lot of things that have changed in police work, but if there's one thing that has not changed, is the discipline system. It's so archaic. It really, really is. Meaning, we're so quick to cut a face sheet and investigate through internal affairs when we can have other options. Like maybe, hey, you can't work overtime for like the next 2 months. And, you know, make that a disciplinary type of punishment, you know, if it's punitive, you know, or other ways you can figure out to discipline, you know, behavior and reduce that, you know, that risk management. But I got to tell you, man, it's those challenges have been an eye opener for me, which is, again, another reason why I decided to start the podcast, is because what happens behind closed doors is where this, you know, influence peddling starts happening. Like, well, do we really, you know, we don't believe them. Maybe they're checked out before I even did my opening arguments. We're going to fire this guy anyways. Who knows? You know, so those are the challenges and the obstacles that happens with this big machine, which, by the way, it's not perfect, you know, and I know that, you know, we're getting better at it. But to your point, I think today's challenge and today's internal affairs, I really believe that it's being used as a weapon. A lot of officers are being weaponized by internal affairs, using them as a weapon, as a tool to get your buddy in trouble, you know, or to get someone you don't like in trouble. I got IA hanging on you. So this is, you know, you keep doing this to me and I'm just going to call IA. And next thing you know, you're going to be in big, big trouble.
You know, it's interesting that a lot of stuff that you're saying, I hear a lot of similarities and differences in comparison with the LAPD and the NYPD. And some of the similarities I hear, it sounds like that you're making the inference to politics and nepotism. And that's something that John and I talk about constantly on this podcast, how politics has infected policing, especially, I believe, the NYPD and LAPD, especially since I think when it comes to policing, the NYPD and LAPD are almost like brother and sister in the style of policing, and also very iconic, right? These are brands. These are police departments that are known throughout the entire world. But I also hear some different, right? Absolutely.
Oh, 100%. I mean, look, let's not deny the fact that there's certain things like there is a double standard. I mean, I've done a really good job of not bashing, you know, my beloved LAPD, because it's afforded me a lot of success. But is there ways to improve? Absolutely. And what sticks out the most, to your point, is the politics, is the double standard, is the nepotism. I mean, there is no way. Look, we have over 20, I think we have about 23 divisions in the entire LAPD. And you would think there's parity. There's not. No way. Look, someone in one division can get a neglected duty type of allegation and get counseled. Or maybe, I don't know, hey, let's just give them an admonishment, you know, paper penalty or official reprimand, you're good to go. Where in the other division, you'll end up getting a 2-day suspension for it. And you're like, wait a minute, hold on a second. It's like, It's my first time I've ever done this. I've got 5 years on, and, you know, hey, that person in that division only got paper penalty, and you're giving me a 3-day suspension? I mean, come on. You know, and so that's where this influence peddling is what I like to call it starts happening behind closed doors. And what I decided to do is kind of pull back the curtains and just keep it. Look, we're going to talk about transparency. Then here you have it, of a topic that is not talked about enough. And that's one of several reasons why I decided to do the podcast. And you know what? It's been so good. I'm blessed. Not just because of the title of the show. It's because a lot of the guests get to come in and really have some closure with something that happened to them in their 30-year career, you know, and at the same time, you're getting validated and you're feeling some affirmation about, look, I know that I'm a great person and everybody, you know, said goodbye and I got awards and I got a cake and took photos. Great. But you know what? Let me tell you about that one time, that blemish that happened with IA. And guess what? No one really knew about it. And I've been doing this for 30 years.
Well, that's what I said. We definitely identified similarities and differences. I think nepotism on a whole is plaguing law enforcement throughout the entire country. It's so egregious, especially in law enforcement, because a lot of the personnel that make up police departments, yes, are a family, a deity, right? So it's, you look out for your nephew, your son, your daughter, then their kids come on the job. So there's a deity that look out for each other. We have that level of nepotism. And also when you're on the job, you start to build your own community of people that you know. And some of those people start to get promoted and they look out for other people. That's part of the nepotism. But also, yes, the differences I see is we're talking, and I see that with the NYPD, we have the CCRB and IAB. And it seems like for LAPD, this is all compassed under Internal Affairs. So it's interesting, you know, throughout my career, predominantly most of my career was working in plainclothes. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because I remember when I used to work in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. I worked in PSA 4, as Police Service Area 4, to the Lower East Side of Manhattan, Compass Housing. And that was actually, it was one of the newer buildings. It was a nice building. So the Internal Affairs guys, they would go out and they would do narcotics operations. Same thing, just as we were doing. It was almost like they were anti-crime. John, you know exactly what I'm talking about. They were anti-crime. These guys were out in plainclothes. They were doing anti-crime work. And at the end, when they locked people up, basically they would just ask them, do you know a dirty cop? And that's their Internal Affairs component to it. But when those guys were in the precinct, other guys were always scared to talk. Like, shh, don't talk those guys around. Like, why? They're cops just like us. You have something, yes, to hide. I didn't care. It didn't bother me, right? And you know what's interesting? If that made me reflect. When you asked me, when you and I were doing the podcast, you asked me, what do I think should be a requirement for an internal affairs investigator? And I said, I believe that you should have had to be an enforcement unit so that you can make a proper assessment on enforcement, right?
Yes.
So I was always happy. When I went to my investigations, I had to use force. I felt comfortable with the internal affairs guys because most of those guys did anti-crime too. Like, that guy was a cop. He understands.
Yes.
And I was exonerated for those cases. But then we had the Civilian Complaint Review Board. That's where I had my most amount of fear and alarm because I knew that the Civilian Complaint Review Board had a disdain for the police. And they were finding me guilty for the same cases that I was exonerated. So put aside that right now, enforcement. This is what I want to ask you because it ultimately affects me and John. And it's affecting the entire media right now. To properly investigate corruption, do you believe that internal affairs should be comprised of LAPD cops for your purposes, for LAPD? Or do you think it should be a separate civilian entity to do a proper investigation?
That's a good question, Eric. I would only say that if you're a small department, I believe in outsourcing. I think that you should completely just be nothing near your own department investigating you. I suppose if you have neighboring agencies in the East Coast that are small, maybe the chief can call the other chief and say, hey, do me a solid and, you know, get this potentially internal. So what I would say is that any internal type of allegations, whistleblower, harassment, discrimination, that whatever, any of those type of allegations, that's tough, man. And corruption in it itself. I know the DA's office here has a corruption unit. I don't know the answer to that, bro. I really don't. Besides the fact that maybe you should grab someone from Florida that doesn't even know anything about the NYPD. Well, better yet, just grab a sharp person from Canada. You know, the Royal Mounted Police Constable, who has a lot of experience in discipline. And that way they can go in with a fresh set of eyes, no bias, very impartial, and they don't know anybody. Besides the fact that, hey, I'm investigating this corruption type of case. You know, and let me do the interviews. Because what ends up happening, and to your point, when I asked you that question in the show, it's a very valid question. What kind of character traits would you expect out of an IA investigator? In other words, if you're in a room full of sergeants that are in internal affairs, what do you want them to know about this job? And what would you expect out of them? And the problem is that if you, even if you say, hey, yeah, I want you to be trustworthy, no stone goes unturned, have the integrity, don't cut corners, don't do anybody any favors. If you open up the door and start investigating, don't close that door until you're fully, fully, fully sure that you've asked every single question that is needed to perhaps not even frame an allegation of misconduct. So, but the problem is that there comes the person, you know, it gets personal. You know, you can be an IO and turn it in, and then your boss can say, you know what? No, I don't want you to frame these allegations. You're like, well, what are you talking about? Because maybe your boss might know the accused, you know. So the best thing, just hire a firm that has absolutely nothing to do with New York whatsoever, doesn't even know Broadway for that matter, you know, doesn't know the Yankees at all, you know, what's baseball. Someone who just has really no complete ties with the department would be probably the best answer that I can give you. But is that something that's going to happen? Probably not. So.
Come on, you brought up false statements, right? I think, in my opinion, false statements get weaponized a lot. And I think in police work, I mean, a lot of times, if us three are on the same scenario, we're going to have three different stories of what actually happened. Not because any of us are lying, but just based on our perception, what we saw, our tunnel vision, all that. Yes. What is a false statement to you? And if someone is found guilty or actually pleads guilty to a false statement, do you believe they should continue on in their police career?
Okay, so you're asking, but that's the golden question. And I just taught last week up in Sacramento. Let me try not to get on my soapbox and get super excited about this, because this is very, very dear to me in a sense that we really mistreat. And we don't practice, when I say we, the department, the IO, we don't practice false statements like they should be. So let me start off by saying that the standard of proof, as we all may know, is preponderance. And preponderance is 51%, right? More likely than not. So what you're saying is that more likely than not, John and Eric lie. Well, here's the challenge. If you're going to call John and Eric a liar, you better have way more than 51%. I know that's the standard of proof. I know that's written somewhere in the manual. You know what? I don't care about that. I need to know that if you're going to be alleging that they're actually liars, you better crank that up to like 90%. You better have such an amount of evidence presented to me as the adjudicator to prove that John and Eric were actually liars. And so if you treat it that way, and by the way, my beloved LAPD actually has a definition, and I'd be more than glad to share it to you, you know, when we're done, I'll send it to you so you can have it. But this is what we teach when we do the Savage Training Group class, is that there is a definition, and believe it or not, a lot of agencies don't even have a policy of a false statement. They just kind of get together and trying to figure out, well, shit, okay, do we have preponderance? I don't know, more likely than not. You know, I can't say, well, John and Eric were at first in Walk and Don't Walk, and Marlon saw him at second and Don't Walk, as an example, right? And the only evidence I have is just Martin saying that they weren't there, you know. And that, sorry, that's not going to work. Who else didn't see John and Eric on Walk and Don't Walk? It's an example. Well, I got to tell you, boss, I don't have anything else besides Marlon's statement. You know what? That's not going to work. You better have like three other witnesses that saw John and Eric completely just way far from Walk and Don't Walk as an example. And the problem is that the weaponization, to your point, John, is that people say things in which they believe is true and accurate. Doesn't mean that you're lying. That's just your perception. That's just what you think is true, is to be accurate and true. Doesn't always work that way. You can't refute someone's truth if you don't have substantial evidence to prove that they're actually lying. It doesn't make any sense. You know, you, especially in-house, I would say internal complaints, those are the toughest ones. Because I can tell you right now from experience, it's not preponderance, man. You can't just walk into IA and say, hey, you know what? Officer Johnson over here was doing this, this, and that. He was harassing me. He was discriminating against me. And they did all this. Just start, you know, labeling all kinds of incidents that happened within that workplace. And you're like, okay, well, that's something that you might believe is true to yourself. But now we got to go find out to see if you're actually lying or not. So it's almost as if the person who's actually making the allegations, you can kind of turn around and say, you know what? Maybe the way you interpret things weren't really true and accurate, you know, because I just got done interviewing five other officers in that unit that had a completely different story than what you said, you know? So it's just really difficult to prove a false statement. And by the way, a false statement allegation in an internal affairs complaint investigation, normally, not all the time, but normally it occurs during the official compelled interview. So if I'm the IO and I'm asking you a set of questions, and for whatever reason, I believe your answers, right, in this compelled interview are not true, then I would frame the allegation of a false statement. But there's other ways also, right? I mean, you can get into DUI and tell the arresting officer a whole different story. And then once you do the compelled interview, you can tell them a whole different story. I'm not saying it's the catch-all that it happens during an official investigation, but from my experience, the one who owns that allegation, the one who framed that particular allegation of a false statement, is normally the investigating officer during that compelled official investigation.
Let's talk about on-duty conduct, right? The performance, yes, of a cop in correlation with the mind, right? I was listening to what you're saying. It's so interesting, right? So we all work off the case Graham versus Connor, right? Which is hindsight. It's absolute in real time when you're involved in incident, exactly, yeah, what your mind sees and believes during the actual incident in real time, right?
Yes.
But when you do an investigation, internal affairs, civilian complaint review board, DA's office, maybe they're looking at a cop, you're held to the to Graham versus Connor, what the cop's perception was on that incident. But the, yes, game has been changed with body cameras, right? So I thought it was so great. You and I were talking about this, and we, yes, talked about the corrupt mind, right?
Yes.
So could you explain how the body cameras have changed investigations? And let's talk about the corrupt mind. And I want you to tell the public and why you believe that investigation should be based on a cop's memory without body camera, or, right, with the use of body cameras when it comes to potentially giving false or misleading statements, because the body camera could be a complete, yes, a different interpretation of what actually, absolutely, happened.
Absolutely.
Please, yes, go into that. Thank you.
Yeah, 100%. Thanks for asking that. And yeah, I just had a conversation before we got on the podcast right here with my partner, James Tacchini, because we're getting ready to do a 2-day OIS course for my beloved LAPD. We're going to do their FBI Marshall Task Force. And basically, first and foremost, that plainclothes detail in the Marshall FBI Task Force for LAPD, they don't have body-worn video. they don't carry him, which is a good thing, you know, because I got to be honest with you. I'm starting to lean. The more I listen to my partner, the more I do this and teach about the corrupt mind or perception, the more I realize that, you know what, perception is the way to go. Because here in the state of California, Graham v. Conner has been codified into our use of force policy. And so now the state starts looking into, okay, it's part of the law now. So you better really explain what it is that you were thinking, you know, at the time that you actually decided to pull the trigger. So the difference is that if you watch body-worn video before you give your compelled interview, there is this, I mean, Dr. Lewinsky's, and I don't know much about that article, but what I do know is that it tends to give the officer a different version of what you actually thought, you know, went down. And that can create doubt. It can create contradicting terms. It can create a lot of inconsistency. And what we don't know, and I'm sure you can attest to this, is that we don't know how the DA's office or any other entity is going to interpret those inconsistencies. So if I give you a statement of perception during my compelled interview without watching body-worn video, and then I go back and actually watch body-worn video, and you start having a lot of discrepancies. Well, you said you were 5 feet away before you actually pulled the trigger. Well, the video shows that you were actually 20 feet apart, you know? And so, and then in your mind, you start thinking, you know what? Even, let's just say you did watch body-worn video. Even in your mind, you're thinking, I was only 5 feet away. But now that I watched it, it shows me 20. If that is the option that you have in your department, that you are allowed to watch body-worn video as an option, right, before your compelled interview, you sit during that interview and just start thinking to yourself, I really honestly thought I was 5 feet away. And so I don't know if that's how we want to treat the most, probably most important decision in your life, because you have to live with the fact that you took someone's life, if that's the case, right? I mean, you get involved in OIS and, you know, someone dies, or you get involved in OIS and they don't die. But that decision, you have to live with that for the rest of your life. And what we fail to do, and this is just my opinion, is that we fail to treat officers with empathy, you know, with the fact that, look, we totally understand that what you were thinking at the time that you pulled the trigger, that's just the way it is. It's true and accurate. I can't sit here and, you know, and walk your shoes to tell you otherwise, but what is it that we do best? We actually do tell you and start asking you questions about, well, you know what, maybe, you know, the frame here in body-worn video, which, by the way, we all know that body-worn video, it's been around since 2015. So we're almost 10 years in, right? And in those 10 years, there's been a lot of science, there's been a lot of research and a lot of studies that it doesn't truly depict the entire picture. And so that's what we have to take in consideration also. So for all you that are listening out there, if you're an agency that has the option to actually watch body-worn video before your compelled administrative interview, I don't know, man. I'm starting to lean where, you know what? Don't do it. Go with perception. Graham v. Conner is the standard. Here in the state of California, it's codified in the use of force policy. And if you want to watch it afterwards, I don't know. You know what? If I was your attorney, your representative, I'm just going to go ahead and lean on the fact that, hey, we're just not watching it, period. You want perception? Here it is. You know, and the problem is that this is going to be a process by which it's going to be in existence for like, what, 2 or 3 years? You have the administrative interview. You might have the criminal proceedings interview. And you got to do the wrongful death civil suit for negligence. You know? So you have three different stages where you have to tell your story, you know. So, and if you get slipped or, you know, or skip a beat or have a lot of inconsistencies, who knows how they're going to treat it? We don't know that. So that's my answer.
I mean, that's a really tough scenario there because, yeah. I mean, listen, the memory is the mind is it fails, right? Your memory of the situation fails as time goes. I think by like a 2 week period,
yes,
your perception of that incident is totally wrong. And that's not if you didn't speak to anybody or you didn't watch the body camera. Now add in you watched your body camera, you spoke to this one, you spoke to that one. Your mind starts putting other things in there. So your memory's totally inaccurate. But I don't know, man. I think I'm watching that body camera because they're going to hold me to the letter of the law, what they saw on there. And I want to know what I'm perceiving now. And is that going to change my memory of the situation and give me an accurate depiction? Yeah, it is. But I'm trying not to go to jail, too. So, right, like, and he is, and like, you know, I'm gonna come from the standpoint that the majority of police-involved shooters, the overwhelming majority of police-involved shootings, the cop went to work that day with the intentions to just go home and did not want to be involved in a shooting, you know? So they felt they were put in that scenario. I mean, but that's my problem with false statements, too, because I've been on so many scenarios, you know, where literally the incident just happened in front of us. One of the guys charging at me with a butcher knife. I yell at him, drop the effing knife or I'm going to shoot you. He drops the knife and we go and handcuff him. My lieutenant was like around the block and he comes over. I was a cop at the time. And he goes, oh my God, I thought you were going to shoot that guy. I've been involved in 3 shootings and I heard it in your voice. I was just waiting for pop, pop. And I was like, yeah, bro. I was like, he was so close with the knife. And my partner goes, what knife? And I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God. I was like, oh my, because if I would have shot him, he didn't even see the knife, you know? And I'm like, look how that scenario changed it. And then in my head, I'm like, the knife's right here. I actually had to look for the knife now on the floor to make sure that he did have a knife. And it wasn't my memory. I didn't perceive that incident wrong. And yeah, the knife was right there, but it just shows how this is not a perfect science. Like the human mind isn't a perfect science, and especially memory. I think me personally, I'm watching that body camera.
And you know what, for the record, just like to make clear that I'm just starting to lean that way. So an LAPD, it's mandatory. I'm going to tell you right now, it's culture. It's a practice. It's mandatory. I'm going to be, you know, tell you without a doubt that the union, they won't allow it. You have to watch body worn video. That's just the way we roll. And you got to give a statement because the chief wants a somewhat within 72 hours. He needs a 72-hour briefing, and he needs to know what's going on. Now, of course, we can talk about sleep deprivation, sleep cycles, and all that good stuff. But hey, man, we're pretty good at what we do. We'll get a statement from an officer and say, hey, you know what? Just give me something very a good synopsis, enough that I can just, you know, write an report and just brief the chief, and then you know you can go home and not do the 2 or 3 hour interview. And I couldn't agree with you more, John. I mean, look, this is probably the most important interview of your life because you're talking about your freedom. And I say this all the time. You're one incident away from getting criminally filed on. That is the honest truth in today's police work. So when you asked me in the beginning about, you know, giving a message to, you know, whoever's coming on the job today, that is reality. Don't stop to think that this job is, you know, I get to do community stuff and, you know, walk the old lady, you know, across the sidewalk or, you know, do all this fun stuff. No, man. At the end of the day, you're going to work graves. You're going to work a lot of overtime. You're going to be away from your family. You're going to work holidays. And guess what? You're one incident away from possibly having some criminal filings faced against you. You're going to lose it all, your freedom. Forget the IA, you know, and that's reality where 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that at all.
I think this is such an interesting topic here. And I think this is a rabbit hole that we could go down from hours, days, weeks, months, right? Yes. Well, I mean,
oh, absolutely.
I'm listening to both of you, right? Your response about perception versus the actual body camera footage. And then I heard what John said, right? And I'm thinking, you know what? You're both right. I think you're both absolutely right. Like, because it happened to me, you know, one of my civilian complaints, I was found guilty by the CCRB. Uh-huh. And we were fighting with a perpetrator that was wanted for a fire, He was wanted for firearm use. He was wanted for several shootings. He had a history of fighting with the police. And immediately when we encountered this particular perpetrator, he already said, listen, I'm not going. I mean, because he knew he was going in. That was it. He's not coming out. He's doing some serious state time. So immediately he threw a punch at me. I ducked the punch. I deployed a strike. We started to fight. In this struggle, I just kept punching because he was biting cops. The cops were using tasers on him. He just wouldn't stop. He was all hopped up on adrenaline, all kinds of substances. And I didn't see it. I just kept deploying strikes because he was fighting like there was no tomorrow. He knew he was going to jail. He was hopped up on substance. He fighting. He was going crazy. Kept punching. And I remember him continuing to throw strikes and bite. And in my CCRB interview, they played the body camera footage. And at some point, they stopped it. And one of my cops had grabbed the perpetrator's arm and was starting to put a cuff on it. I never saw that. I just felt him continually fighting. And I kept deploying punches. And they found me guilty. So it's so interesting, but what you both are saying, right? Because I'm kind of asking the question now, right? So if I testify without watching the body camera footage of what I felt and what I saw, that's the truth, is it not? That's the truth. Can we all agree that's the truth?
100%. 100%. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. If you watch body worn video, you were going to say.
No, but I'm saying that part is the truth. That's what I felt. That's what I saw. That's what Grant versus Connor is, right? But now, if I watch the body camera and I look at it, I go, wait a minute. I never saw that hand, but I testified, yes, there's a hand there, and I kept striking, and I start to try to give a reason why I kept striking. Isn't that now kind of a lie? And I agree with John, because John shakes his head, because I agree with John, because you both said something here. It's fantastic. We actually have to go back and watch this. Any cops that are out there, you have to watch and listen to what you guys were saying. It's fantastic, because I'm sitting here saying to myself, wow, you're right, Marlon, because that's the standard, right? The standard is the preponderance of evidence. But what John is saying is right, too. That's the new standard. The new standard is not really what's law. It's what's optics. So I need to watch the body camera to protect myself. So how do we get to a point that it's accurate? Could it be? Could this be possible? Or this is just completely stupid? Could we have two sets of standards that you testify to your incident without body camera, and then you also testify with body camera? Could we have two standards in the same case?
I think what happens is, and you know, I don't know how many agencies practice this, but if you do give a statement without watching body worn video, what they'll end up doing is, okay, let's go watch body worn video and just kind of clean up these discrepancies. If any, for all you know, you might have a great mind and just say exactly what happened on the body worn video. It could be, I don't know. But let's just say it's not, and you have some discrepancies, right? There's some there might be some inconsistencies. Maybe you didn't see him with the holding the weapon in his right arm, and it just happens that when you watch body worn video, it was in the left arm. So what you'll do is you'll clean up all those inconsistencies, which is fine. I think that's great. My only fear to that is if it's an OIS that's sensationalized, if it's a newsworthy event, if it's, you know, it can become political. And what you don't know is the levels of review. I think the IO, and maybe your lieutenant, the next level, you know, your boss, I think we're fine there. But what we don't know is all the levels of review and the fact that it might get political. That's what I'm afraid of. And to John's point, then I'm fucking watching it. I'm scrubbing. And that's what we do in LAPD, by the way. We do. We watch it. We scrub it. I tell when I used to, and by the way, I'm not just the IA guy. We actually have a unit in LAPD because we're so big. It's called Officer Representation Section, ORS. And then this section is comprised of sergeants. And our primary duty is to roll out to these critical incidents, OIS is being the most popular because they happen the most. And so the attorney rolls out and represents the shooting officer. And that's what they get paid the big bucks for. And guess who stuck with all the other compelled interviews? The rep, the defense rep, where we have to do all who were substantially involved, you name it, public safety statement, the sergeant at scene, command and control. Just, I mean, like you end up with like 10 interviews for that matter. And so that's where I gained the experience of rolling out to all these OISs, where I can kind of walk you from the minute that the officer pulls the trigger up until IA says, all right, we're done investigating this, and we walk away. And so our job a lot of the times was to have the officers, the witnesses, right, the percipient witnesses who were substantially involved. And sometimes I would sit in with the shooting officer, and we would watch body-worn video. And sometimes you'll catch them. They're like, oh, you know what? And I think more than anything, just from experience, they feel like they really want to know how they actually performed or how they how it actually went down, because we can all agree that the average OIS is, it's got to be less than 2 seconds. You know, so it happens so quickly that you kind of forget exactly what led up to you breaking leather, you know, and popping rounds. I mean, that to me, especially now, knowing that this is the most important interview of your life, you know, you're talking about your freedom here. Yeah, let's watch it. But what I'm saying is that sometimes maybe it is perception. You know, look, there's a reason why Dr. Lewinsky and Forest Science Institute exist. There is a reason for that. I mean, he's been doing this for decades. I'm a true believer of that. And maybe, you know, so just want to make sure that we understand that we're not saying that one's right and the other one's wrong. We're just saying that you have this option and not one's right or wrong, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And like, and what I'm saying about the body camera watching it, I'm not saying watch it and then try to concoct a story to correct, make it all fit. I'm saying watch it so you know, so you don't get caught off guard like Eric. Like, yeah, no, I know the body camera showed that his hand was getting cuffed. I didn't see that.
Yeah.
The body camera's on my chest. I'm looking up at him. So correct, at least you know your perception with versus what the body camera picked up. Correct. Because that's the other thing that, like, I think the public misconstrues, and I think the brass misconstrues a lot too. Yes. That body camera is not what I saw. I'm doing this. My body camera is stationary, you know? And so, like, that's when I said watch the body camera, I'm not saying to try to conjoin the two. I'm saying this is my reality. Yes. Okay. I see that on the camera. That happened, but I didn't see that, you know? Yeah. And that's what I meant by that. Ma, I know I know you got a time constraint going, so I don't want to hold you. Questions. We want to have you back on more too to discuss other issues as they go on, because do need an internal affairs perspective on a lot of things.
I would love to.
But I asked retired guys the same two questions.
Talk to me.
I asked them, at the time you came on the police department, at the age you were, would you do it again?
Oof. I'm going to say yes, only because it really, you mean knowing what I know now?
No, not knowing what you know now. At the time, I bring you back. You're 25. You don't know what you know now.
I'm going to have to go with yes, because it's the unknown, man. It's a great career. It really was. I'm all with the unknown and being pumped to serving. And it's just, look, when I came on, the most exciting part about police work was what we used to call license plate lotto. We used to just run plates all the time on patrol, just run plates, and hoping that one comes back stolen. Oh my God, it's got to come back stolen. And once it does, the chase is on. Code 37 vehicle requesting an airship and a backup. And now that rush is just, look, it takes a special person to do that. It really, truly does. Or, you know, 211 in progress, robbery in progress, or, you know, something along those lines where it's actually going down. And you want to be the hero and you want to get there and solve it and stop it and do what you have to do. So for those reasons and those reasons alone, absolutely. I would say yes. Second question.
All right. Now I'm going to bring you right now, the police environment right now. You know what you know.
Yes.
You know what you know, but you're back to being a young man with the knowledge of a 25-year veteran. Do you come on now?
No, for these reasons. One of the reasons is because, okay, so you are asking me to come on the job and arrest bad people, people who committed violent crimes for that matter, and within 24 hours or less, they get to get out. That doesn't make any sense to me. Why would I want to do that? You know, if I just got done watching someone commit the most heinous violent crime and I come back to work 3 days later and I see the same person walking down the street, that doesn't make any sense to me. That would be one. Two, you know, it's we're one incident away from just being back to what happened with George Floyd. That could be the case where we're going to get defunded. And you know what? No, John, I don't like to be called. I think at one point we were labeled agents of racial genocide. That doesn't sit well with me whatsoever. To be called evil, to be called pigs, to be called killers does not sit well with me at all. So for those reasons and those reasons alone, no, I wouldn't want to do this type of profession. You know, there's a lot of perks. You're probably getting paid pretty well here in the state of California. But know this, that if you're listening and watching and you got to do this job, you know, it's got to come from the heart. Something that you really, really want to do is to help people out and serve your community. Because here's the issue. Just because you wanted to become a civil engineer and you didn't pass your exams and all of a sudden you say, oh, my God, they're going to pay me $80,000. I can make $100,000 in like less than 2 years. Or you wanted to be a nurse, a general contractor, or you, I don't know, you were playing minor league baseball and, you know, you're not going to make it to the big leagues. And you know what? Now I want to be a cop because they get paid well. You might want to self-reflect and think about why you want to do this profession. I don't know if that's the kind of answer you're looking for, but that's my final answer, and I'm sticking to it. So,
you know, it's unfortunate, but we always ask that question, and
what do you get?
100%.
Not one person.
100% of the time. So.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. No. It hasn't failed yet. It hasn't failed yet.
Every time, listen. If we ask guys that question, go back in time. I'm on board. Like just what you said, that adrenaline rush, like getting to actually be a cop, that, you know, that rush you get. Yeah. But when we ask everybody about it now, everybody says the same thing. Hell no. I'm waiting for that one guy. It hasn't come yet.
Yeah. You know what? It's just, I really honestly feel that there's the expectations are just a little too extreme, man. They're super high. They're asking so much for you to do. And then here's the shittiest part. Before, you know, we wrap it up is you can get involved in an OIS and do everything that you thought in your mind and perceived to be the right thing to do. This is how I was trained. These are the tactics that were taught to me. And this is exactly what I did. And you can still end up looking at not just administrative misconduct, but you can also end up maybe with some possible criminal filings. And again, I don't want to be, you know, Debbie Downer, you know, bash like, oh my God, this is a bad profession. But you just got to know the rules of the game. And I honestly believe that if you're on now, you got to work within your rules. But just be smart. You know what? If you have body worn cameras, I don't know, be that ESPN narrator, that colorful narrator, and do exactly what you know. Yeah, be like my boy Dan Patrick. I love Dan Patrick. You know, and just, you know, tell it like it is. Hey, today is April 29th. We're at 4 p.m. We're here at scene, you know, on Broadway, and we're dealing with Mr. Johnson, and here we go, and let it be. So it's not a bad thing, but just know that the rules of the games have changed.
Marlon, you always say this, and I can't agree with you more. I mean, now that we're in this realm, John, myself, Sal Greco, yourself, Hector Bravo, we're building this network, this community of all these cops that have become YouTubers and podcasts, and we're spreading our message, memorializing careers. And you always say we need more of them. And I am with you. And it's been a pleasure getting to know you. I definitely consider you a friend. Like I said, East meets West. We have to start finding guys in Middle America to keep building this network and building an army together. I can't thank you enough. Please, thank you so much for taking your time out and coming on here. Thank you for your story. The stuff you said about body cam, I love it. Please tell everybody where they can find you, if you could plug your podcast. And last thing, I know you're leaving for the game. Lakers and Denver, who you got tonight?
Oh, no, I want, you know, look, man, I don't want to sound too political here, but the fakers have to go, man. You know, I got my own, you know, whoever's watching, I got my own opinions on a certain goat, what they call the goat, if you will, you know, and we'll leave it at that. But no, I got to have Denver just send them home, send them home. That's, you know, and that sucks. You know, I'm in LA, you know, but that's just the way it is. Internal Affairs, a police podcast on YouTube. It's please go in there, subscribe. Look, the stories are just real. I like to describe it rich in content or rich. Yeah, there's a segment in the episode where you're going to tell me an IA story, but man, we get to have fun and talk about your career. I get to ask you worst incident in your career, best achievement or best incidents in your career. We get to go trip down memory lane and we get to talk about internal affairs. Hey, you know what? On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the highest, I'll rate the importance of internal affairs in a department and tell me why. So, John, you're up next, brother. You got to come on. I would love to have you on. And thank you for having me. I think it's so important that we go across the nation like we're doing now. There will never be enough platforms for us to get our word out. And what we're doing is something that should have been done a long time ago. Unfortunately, you know, the masses doesn't allow us to, you know, to get the message out back then. But thank God that we have social media and YouTube and all that to, you know, for us to get to know each other. Look, for me, the best part of this journey ever since I started this in November, I've only been doing this for 4 months. In the podcast is meeting some outstanding people like yourselves and others. It's a blessing. God does his work through people. We are instruments. I really, truly, truly 100% believe in that. And thank you so, so much for having me on your podcast.
Well, before we let you go.
Yes, sir.
Give us your social media handles and just last word to the audience.
Yes. It's Internal Affairs Police Podcast on Instagram. You can find me on LinkedIn, Marlon Marache, M-A-R-L-O-N, last name Marache, M-A-R-R-A-C-H-E. And my parting words is that, you know what? This is an awesome profession. Be smart, be flexible, and take care of yourselves as much as possible.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in. We'll be back at you.
Law enforcement professionals dedicate their lives to serving and protecting our community. But who's protecting their financial futures? That's where Laidlaw Blue comes in. Our wealth management platform is specifically designed for the law enforcement community. Laidlaw Blue is a division within Laidlaw Wealth Management, run by retired New York City detective John McDermott. His status as a retired detective uniquely positions him to establish a deep connection between Laidlaw Blue and the law enforcement community. Our platform is easy to use and provides a range of financial services, including investment management, retirement planning, and insurance solutions. With Laidlaw Blue, you can secure your financial future and provide for your loved ones. Our team of experienced financial advisors understands the unique challenges and opportunities that law enforcement professionals face. We're here to help you navigate the complexities of financial planning and achieve your goals. Laidlaw Blue, secure your financial future today. Book a meeting using the QR code displayed or call us directly on 888-901-BLUE. That's 888-901-BLUE.